have formed private armies and hired out as mercenaries. Their audacity has captured the loyalty of many Russians who tired quickly of capitalism and freedom. Many in Parliament and the streets yearn for a reactionary nationalism that would restore the glories of Russia. There are pure Cossack units in the Russian army with their own costumes and ranks. They have declared a new Russia around the Black Sea and are expanding into other areas, 7 million strong. That pin you found is the emblem of their movement. It shows the sun in a new dawn for Russia. They're still a minority, Ivan. How much damage can they do? The Bolsheviks were only a minority, but they knew what was in the Russian heart, that the soldiers were tired of war and the peasants wanted land. The Bolsheviks had Lenin. "Thank you for making my point," Petrov said with a humorless smile. "Absolutely correct. The revolution would have been nothing if not for a determined and ruthless leader who unified the country and squashed opponents under his thumb." The smile vanished. "The Cossacks have a similar leader. His name is Mikhail Ratsov. He is an immensely wealthy shipping and mining magnate who owns a cartel named Atman Industries. He is dedicated to the resurrection of Great Russia. He endorses the Cossack ideals of masculinity and brute force. He has said the best way to wipe out corruption is with a machine gun. He is totally paranoid, believes that the rest of the world is out to get him. Money and power are a potent formula. It goes far beyond that." Petrov lit up another cigarette. Austin was surprised to see that the match hand was trembling. "He is advised by a monk named Boris, a man of great animal magnetism with a reputation for prophecy. He exerts an evil influence over Ratsov, encouraging his claim that he is a true descendant of the Tsar, going back to Peter the Great." "I was under the impression that Tsar Nicholas was the last of the Romanov line. There have always been questions." "Even so, I can say I'm the king of Spain, but that doesn't put me on his throne." "Ratsov says he has proof."
"DNA?"
"I doubt if he would let anyone take a blood sample."
"You may be onto something," Austin conceded. "You have a movement, a charismatic leader guided by a messianic prophet and a hereditary line. I agree, that sounds like a potent formula for revolution."
Petrov nodded solemnly. "There is no maybe about it. Russia is on the verge of a neo-Cossack revival that will sweep across the country, wiping out all the gains we have made. The Tsar and his family have already been canonized by the right wing in our country, and Ratsov is poised to take on his sacred mantle." He smiled. "How many politicians can claim to be descended from a saint?"
"Most of them claim to be saints.
But I take your point.
What's your role in this, Ivan?
Are you with the KGB? The KGB has been infiltrated by Ratsov's people. I lead a small inner group whose job is to keep watch on those who threaten Russia's stability. We report directly to the president, but I've only told you part of the story. This involves you too, Mr. Austin. Ratsov considers the United States to be the head of a dark, worldwide conspiracy that is largely responsible for Russia's ills. He believes America is deliberately using its power around the world to keep Russia impoverished and backward. Many in Parliament share his views."
"America has a long list of enemies. It goes with being the only superpower."
"Add Ratsov's name to the roster, then." "But this isn't just political. He has a personal reason as well. His fiancée was accidentally killed in the Americans' bombing of Belgrade several years ago. I understand Irini was quite beautiful, and he has never gotten over her loss. So I would urge you to take him very seriously, especially as there are signs he intends to cause great harm to your country.
In what way?
Petrov spread his hands. We don't know. We know only that he has given his scheme a name, Operation Troika.
Then you've wasted your time and mine.
You should use diplomatic channels to take your case to higher-ups in the American government.
We already have.
We have told them we want them to avoid any overt moves.
I can't picture the White House and the Pentagon ignoring a possible threat like this, not now.
They've learned the hard way to take threats seriously.
Yes, well, they're not pleased with our position. We have told them if they respond too clumsily, they will spoil our efforts and ensure that the threat, whatever it is, will be carried out.
What's the connection between this threat and the sub-base?
Come to your own conclusion.
The sub-pen was built for medium-range missile submarines that roamed the Black Sea, mostly to intimidate Turkish leaders who allowed the Americans to establish bases. It was abandoned after the Soviet government fell and lay undisturbed for years. Then Ratsov leased the facility from the government. His ships were seen coming and going. The Cossacks you encountered were camped nearby as guards.
Why the fancy costumes and old weapons?
It has something to do with the symbolism of his cause. Ratsov chooses to equip some of his men as if they were still cavalry for the Tsar.
Make no mistake, he has accumulated many modern weapons from the former Soviet Union.
Why haven't you moved in on these guys?
We were waiting and watching for the right time. Then you blundered in.
Sorry to spoil your stakeout. Someone was being mugged and needed help.
We think he intends to act against the U.S. before he assumes power.
I can help you find out what he has in mind.
Petrov shook his head vigorously.
We don't need American cowboys charging in with six guns blazing.
Neither do I. I'm a scientist with NUMA now.
You're being disingenuous. You have a reputation for bending the rules. I know about your special assignments team. My office has press accounts of the NUMA team's role in the Andrea Doria conspiracy and the plot to take over the freshwater resources of the world.
We like to keep busy in our spare time.
Then keep busy with your ocean science.
Austin folded his arms over his chest.
Let me see if I understand this correctly, Ivan. You want us to count fish while your madman goes on a terror spree in our country.
We have every intention of stopping Ratsov before it gets to that.
Your interference may already have spoiled any chance we have of containing him. If you don't stay out, I will consider you an enemy of the Russian people and will act accordingly.
Thanks for the advice.
Austin glanced at his watch. I hate to break off our reunion, but I'm late for dinner with a lovely young woman. So, if you're through?
Yes, I'm through.
Petrov barked an order in Russian. The men guarding Austin pulled him to his feet and attempted to herd him toward the door. He stood his ground and said, "Nice seeing you again, Ivan. Sorry for past encounters."
What's past is past. It's the future that we should both be concerned about.
Petrov's hand went to his scar.
You know, Mr. Austin, you taught me a very valuable lesson.
Which is?
Know your enemy.
Austin was hustled down the dark hallway into the rickety elevator. Minutes later, he was in the taxi. The driver kept the car more or less under Mach 1. Before long, they pulled up at the exact point where he'd been kidnapped. "Out," said the driver. Austin was glad to comply. He had to jump back to keep his toes from being crushed as the car sped off in a squeal of tires. He watched the taillights vanish around a corner, then walked to the Argo's slip. Back aboard the ship, he called the hotel where Kayla was staying. When she didn't answer her room phone, he asked the desk if she'd left a message.
"Yes, sir, there's a message from Ms. Dorn," the desk clerk said.
"Would you read it to me, please?"
"Of course. It says, waited an hour. Something more important must have come up. Went to dinner with the boys. Kayla."
Austin frowned. The message said nothing about getting together at another time. He would have to mend fences in the morning. Meanwhile, he went out on the Argo's deck and paced from one end of the ship to the other, trying to remember every detail of the dialogue with Ivan. As he walked, his lips tightened in determination. Damned if he was going to ignore a threat to his country. The best way to get Austin to do something was to tell him he couldn't do it. He went back into his cabin and punched out a number on his cell phone. 5,000 miles away, Jose Joe Zavala plucked the purring cell phone from the dashboard holder of his 1961 Corvette convertible and answered with a cheery hello. Zavala had been thinking how all was right with the world. He was young, healthy, and on an undemanding work project that left him plenty of free time. At his side was a lovely blonde statistical analyst from the Department of Commerce. They were driving along a country road in McLean, Virginia, on their way to a candlelight dinner at a romantic old inn. The warm air pleasantly tousled his thick black hair. After dinner, it would be back to the former district library building in Arlington, where he lived, for a nightcap. Then, who knows? The possibilities were endless. This could be the start of a long relationship, long being a relative term in Zavala's world. When he heard the voice of his friend and colleague, Zavala's reaction was a happy one. A slight smile cracked the ends of his lips. "Buenas era, Kurt, old amigo. How's your vacation?" "Over." "So is yours, I'm sorry to say." Zavala's smile faded and a pained expression came onto his darkly handsome features as Austin laid out his plans for Joe's immediate future. With a mighty sigh, he replaced the phone, looked soulfully into the dreamy and compliant blue eyes of his date, and said, "I'm afraid I've got bad news. My grandmother just died." While Zavala tried to cushion his date's disappointment with an improvised list of outrageous promises, Paul Trout's 6'8" figure was bent like a praying mantis over a lab counter at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts, examining mud samples from the deepest parts of the Atlantic Ocean. Although the work was potentially messy, Trout's white lab coat was spotless. He wore one of his trademark bright bow ties, and his light brown hair was parted down the middle and combed back at the temples. Trout grew up in Woods Hole, where his father was a Cape Cod fisherman, and he returned to his roots whenever he got the chance. He had developed friendships with many of the scientists at the world-renowned institution and often lent them his skills as a deep ocean geologist. Trout's intense concentration was broken by the sound of his name being called. Keeping his head lowered to the sample, he peered upward and saw a lab tech standing there. "Call just came in for you, Dr. Trout," she said, handing him a phone. Trout's mind was still on the ocean bottom, and when he heard Austin's voice, he assumed the head of the special assignments team was at NUMA headquarters. "Kurt, you already back home?" "Actually, I'm calling from Istanbul, where you'll be in 24 hours. I've got a job for you in the Black Sea." Trout blinked his hazel eyes. "Istanbul? The Black Sea?" His reaction was the complete opposite of Zavala's.
I've always wanted to work there. My colleagues will be green with envy. How soon can you leave?
I'm up to my ears in mud, but I can leave for Washington immediately.
There was silence at the other end of the line as Austin pictured Trout in a pool of muck.
Austin was used to Trout's Yankee eccentricities and decided he didn't want to know the details. He simply said, "Could you pass this along to Gamay?"
"Finest kind, Cap," Trout said, using an old fisherman's expression that spoke for itself. "See you tomorrow."
20 feet below the surface of the water east of Marathon in the Florida Keys, Trout's wife, Gamay, was chiseling away with a dive knife at a big brain coral. She broke off a small piece and put it in a mesh bag hanging from her weight belt. Gamay had donated some of her working vacation as a marine biologist to a conservation group studying the deterioration of coral growth in the Keys. The news wasn't good. The coral was worse than the year before. The growth that had not been killed outright by the poisonous runoff from South Florida was brown and discolored, totally unlike the vibrant colors to be found in the healthy reefs of the Caribbean and Red Sea. A sharp rapping sound filled her ears. Someone was signaling from the surface. Tucking her knife back in its sheath, Gamay increased the air in her buoyancy compensator, and with a few flips of her fins, her tightly shaped body rose from the coral. She surfaced near the chartered dive boat and blinked in the bright Florida sun. The boat's skipper, a grizzled old conch named Bud, after the beer he favored, was holding a ball-peen hammer he'd used to tap on the metal stern ladder.
"Harbor Master just called on the radio," Bud yelled. "Says your husband was trying to get in touch with you."
Gamay swam to the ladder, handed up her tank and weight belt, then climbed aboard. She wrung the seawater out of her dark red hair and wiped her face down with a towel. She was tall and slim for her height, and had she cared to get down to an unhealthy weight, she would have the figure of a fashion model. She dug the coral fragment from her bag and held it up for Bud to see. He shook his head.
"My dive business is going down the tubes if this keeps up."
The fisherman was right. It was going to take a massive commitment of everyone, from the conchs to the Congress, to bring the reefs back to life.
"Did my husband leave a message?" she asked.
"Yeah, says to get in touch with him pronto. That someone named Kurt called. Guess your vacation is over."
She smiled, showing the slight space between her dazzling white front teeth, and tossed the piece of coral to Bud.
"Guess it is," she said.
Chapter 10, Washington, D.C. Washington sweltered under a hot sun that combined with the humidity to transform the nation's capital into a giant steam bath. The driver of the turquoise Jeep Cherokee shook his head in wonder at the brave clusters of tourists ignoring the wilting heat. Noel Coward to the contrary, he thought. Mad dogs and Englishmen weren't the only ones to go out in the midday sun. Minutes later, the Jeep pulled up to the White House gate, and the man at the wheel handed over a NUMA identification card with the name and photo of Admiral James Sandecker, while one guard used a mirror on a pole to check underneath the vehicle for a bomb. The other returned the ID to the driver, a trim man with flaming red hair and a Van Dyke beard.
"Good day, Admiral Sandecker," the guard said, with a broad grin.
"Nice to see you again.
It's been a few weeks. How are you today, sir?"
"I'm fine, Norman," said Sandecker.
"You're looking well. How are Dolores and the children?"
"Thank you for asking," the guard said, beaming with pride.
"She's great. Kids are doing well in school. Jamie wants to work for NUMA when she gets out of college."
"Splendid. Make sure she calls me directly. The agency is always on the lookout for bright young people."
The guard let out a hearty laugh.
"It won't be for a while. She's only 14.
He jerked his thumb toward the White House.
"They're all in there waiting for you, Admiral."
"Thank you for letting me know," Sandecker replied. "Please give my regards to Dolores."
As the guard waved him through the gate, Sandecker thought how being gracious had more than its immediate rewards. by dealing warmly with guards, secretaries, receptionists, and others considered low in the bureaucratic hierarchy, he had established an early warning network all over the city. His lips compressed in a tight smile. Norman's wink and nod signaled Sandecker that his arrival had been scheduled after the others, so they could confer before he arrived. He had a well-earned reputation for promptness, a habit shaped at the U.S. Naval Academy and honed by his years of flag rank. He always arrived exactly 1 minute before a meeting. A tall, dark-suited man wearing the sunglasses and granite expression that marked him as a Secret Service agent checked Sandecker's ID again, directed him into a parking space, and whispered into his hand radio. He led the admiral to an entrance where a smiling young female aide met him and escorted him down the hushed corridors to a door guarded by a lantern-jawed marine. He opened the door and Sandecker stepped into the cabinet room. Warned by the Secret Service man that Sandecker was on his way, President Dean Cooper Wallace was waiting to ambush the admiral with a handshake. The president was known as the most eager flesh-presser to occupy the White House since Lyndon Johnson.
"Great to see you, Admiral," Wallace said. "Thank you for coming on such short notice."
He pumped Sandecker's hand as if he were courting votes at a church fair. Sandecker managed to detach himself from the president's grip and responded with a charm offensive of his own. He went around the table and greeted each man by his first name, asking about wife, children, or golf game. He had a particularly warm greeting for his friend Irwin LeGrand, the tall, Lincoln-esque director of the CIA. Numa's director was only a few inches over 5 feet, yet his presence filled the large chamber with the energy of a testosterone dynamo. The president sensed that Sandecker was overshadowing him. He snagged the admiral and guided him by the elbow to a seat at the long conference table.
"Got the place of honor reserved for you."
Sandecker slipped into his seat to the president's left. Sandecker knew his placement at the president's elbow was no accident and was meant to flatter him. Despite a folksy manner that made him sound at times like the actor Andy Griffith, Wallace was a shrewd politician. As always, Vice President Sid Sparkman was seated on the president's right. The president sat down and grinned.
"I was telling the boys here about the one that got away. Hooked a grandpappy trout as big as a whale last time I was out west. Snapped my rod in half. Guess that old fellow didn't know he was dealing with the commander-in-chief of the USA.
The men at the table responded to the homily with loud laughter, the loudest coming from the vice president. Sandecker chuckled dutifully. He'd had warm relations with all those who occupied the White House during his tenure at NUMA. Whatever their political persuasion, every president he dealt with respected his power in Washington and his influence with universities and corporations around the country and world. Sandecker was not universally loved, but even his adversaries admired his hard-driving honesty. Sandecker exchanged smiles with the vice president. Older than Wallace by several years, the vice president was the éminence grise at the White House, wielding his power out of sight of the public, covering his Machiavellian machinations and hard-knuckle style with jovial bonhomie. The former college football player was a self-made millionaire. Sandecker knew the vice president secretly held Wallace in the contempt that men who have achieved success on their own sometimes have for those who have inherited their wealth and connections.
"Hope you gentlemen don't mind if we get down to business," said the president, who was dressed casually in a plaid shirt, navy blazer, and khaki slacks. "Air Force One is all gassed up to take me to Montana for another crack at that trout."
He made a show of glancing at his watch.
"I'm turning the meeting over to the Secretary of State to fill you in."
A tall, hawk-faced man, with his white hair so carefully coiffed that it looked like a helmet, gazed around the room with piercing eyes. Nelson Tingley reminded Sandecker of what an astute observer had said about Daniel Webster, that Webster looked too good to be true. Tingley hadn't been a bad senator, but he had let his cabinet position go to his head. The secretary saw himself playing the role of Bismarck to Wallace's Frederick the Great. In truth, he seldom got the president's ear because he had to go through Sparkman. As a consequence, he tended to grandstand when he got the chance.
"Thank you, Mr. President," he said in the sonorous voice that for years had echoed across the floor of the U.S. Senate. "I'm sure you gentlemen all know the severity of the situation in Russia. Within the next few weeks, or possibly days, we can expect the fall of that country's legally elected president. Their economy is at an all-time low, and Russia is expected to default on its obligations around the world."
"Tell them what you said about the army," the president suggested.
"I'd be happy to, Mr. President. The Russian forces are up for grabs. The public is sick of the corruption in government and of the power of organized crime. Nationalist sentiment and antagonism toward the United States and Europe are at an all-time high. In short, Russia is a tinderbox that can be touched off at any time by the slightest of incidents."
He paused to let his words sink in and glanced in Sandecker's direction. Sandecker knew the secretary was famous for his filibusters and wasn't about to subject himself to a long-winded lecture. He cut the secretary off at the oratorical pass.
"I assume you're talking about the Black Sea incident involving Numa," Sandecker said pleasantly.
The secretary was derailed but not discouraged.
"With all due respect, Admiral, I would hardly describe an incursion into a country's air and sea space and unauthorized invasion of its sovereign territory as an incident."
"Nor would I describe it as an invasion, Mr. Secretary. As you know, I considered the encounter important enough to submit a full report immediately to the State Department, so they would not be caught by surprise in the event the Russian government complained. But let's look at the facts, shall we?"
Sandecker seemed as calm as a Buddhist at repose.
An American television crew had its boat shot out from under it, and a Turkish fisherman whom they hired was killed. They had no choice but to swim to shore. They were about to be attacked by bandits when a Numa engineer who had been looking for them went to their aid. Later, he and the television people were rescued by a Numa ship.
"All done without going through the proper channels," the secretary countered.
"I'm not unaware of the incendiary situation in Russia, but I hope we aren't blowing this out of proportion. The whole incident took less than a few hours. The television crew was remiss in venturing within national waters, but there was no harm done."
The secretary made a show of opening a folder emblazoned with the State Department emblem.
"Not according to this report from your agency. In addition to the Turkish fishermen, at least one Russian national was killed, and others may have been injured in this so-called incident."
"Has the Russian government delivered a protest through the proper channels you mentioned?"
The National Security Advisor, a man named Rogers, leaned forward.
"There has been no word from the Russians or the Turks to date."
"Then I suggest this is a tempest in a teapot," Sandecker said.
"If the Russians complain about a breach in their national sovereignty, I will be glad to lay out the facts, apologize personally to the Russian ambassador, whom I know quite well through Numa's joint ventures with his country, and assure him it won't happen again."
Secretary Tingley addressed Sandecker, but he was looking at the president when he spoke, his words dripping with acid.
"I hope you won't take this personally, Admiral. But we're not going to have a bunch of ocean groupies dictating the foreign policy of the United States."
The tart comment was meant to be funny, but no one laughed, least of all Sandecker, who didn't take kindly to having Numa described as a bunch of ocean groupies. Sandecker flashed a barracuda smile, but an icy coldness crept into his authoritative blue eyes as he prepared to rip Tingley to shreds. The vice president saw what was coming and rapped his knuckles on the table.
It seems you gentlemen have stated your case with the usual conviction. We don't want to take up any more of the president's valuable time. I'm sure the admiral considers the secretary's points well taken and that Secretary Tingley accepts Numa's explanation and assurances.
Tingley opened his mouth to reply, but Sandecker deftly took advantage of the exit door Sparkman had opened.
I'm glad the secretary and I were able to settle our differences amicably, he interjected.
The president, who was known to dislike confrontation, had been listening with a pained expression on his face. He smiled and said, Thank you, gentlemen. Now that's settled, I've got a more important matter I'd like to bring up.
The disappearance of the NR-1 submarine, Sandecker said.
The president stared at Sandecker in disbelief, then burst into laughter.
I've always heard you've got eyes in the back of your head, Admiral.
How'd you hear about that?
I was told the matter was top secret.
He glanced around reprovingly at his staff.
Real graveyard stuff.
Nothing mysterious about it, Mr. President. Many of our people are in daily close contact with the Navy, which owns the NR-1, and some of the men on board have worked with Numa.
Captain Logan's father is a friend and former colleague of mine. Family members who were concerned for the safety of their loved ones contacted me to ask what was being done. They assumed I was aware of the sub's project.
We owe you an apology, the president said. We were trying to keep this matter contained until we made some progress.
Of course, Sandecker said.
Did the submersible sink?
We've conducted a thorough search.
The sub didn't sink.
I don't understand.
What happened to it?
The president glanced at the CIA director.
The people over at Langley think the NR-1 was hijacked.
Has anyone contacted you to verify that theory?
A request for ransom, perhaps?
No, no one.
Then why hasn't news of the sub's disappearance been made public? It might help in tracking down its whereabouts. I'm sure I don't have to remind anyone in this room that there was a crew on that sub, to say nothing of the millions spent to develop her.
The vice president took over. We don't think it's in the best interests of the crew to go public now, Sparkman declared.
It seems to me that broadcasting a worldwide alert would be in their best interests.
Under ordinary circumstances, yes, but this is pretty complicated, Admiral, the president said. We think it will jeopardize their welfare.
Perhaps, Sandecker said, without conviction. He pinioned Wallace with an unwavering gaze.
I assume you have a plan?
The president shifted uneasily in his chair.
Sid, you got an answer for the admiral?
We're trying to be optimistic, but it is possible that all the crew are dead, Sparkman said.
You have evidence to support that conclusion?
None, but it's a strong possibility.
I can't accept possibility as a reason for sitting on our hands.
The Secretary of State had been simmering like a pot on a hot stove. At the presumed insult, he boiled over.
We are not sitting on our hands, Admiral. The Russian government has requested that we stay out of this for the time being. They have the contacts to chase this down. We'd stir things up, especially with nationalism riding so high. Isn't that right, Mr. President?
Don't tell me you think the Russians took the sub, Sandecker said, ignoring the secretary and directing his question at the president.
Wallace again turned to his vice president.
Sid, you've been on top of this since day one. Can you explain to the admiral?
Of course, Mr. President, I'd be happy to.
It relates to our earlier topic, Admiral. Shortly after the NR-1 disappeared, we were contacted by sources within the Russian government who said they might be able to retrieve the sub and its crew. They believe its disappearance ties in with the turmoil in their country. Beyond that, I can't say for now.
I can only ask your forbearance and patience.
I fail to follow that line of logic, Sandecker said, boring in. Are you saying we should rely upon a government that could fall at any moment to protect our people? It seems to me that the Russian top brass are going to be concentrating more on saving their butts than looking for an American research submarine.
The vice president nodded in agreement. Nonetheless, we have agreed to hold off. Even with their problems, the Russians are in the best position to handle something that's happened in their backyard.
CIA Director LeGrand had been silent up to now.
I'm afraid he's got a point, James.
Sandecker smiled. LeGrand must have been brought in as the good cop to play off bad cop Tingley. The Admiral could play games, too. He furrowed his brow as if he were making a tough decision.
It appears my good friend Irwin concurs with your caution.
Very well, then. I won't press the point further. There was heavy silence in the cabinet room, as if no one could believe Sandecker would give in after only a skirmish.
Thank you, James, President Wallace said. We had a chance to chat before you arrived. We know there's a big temptation, especially with your personal interest in this, to bring Numa in.
You're asking me to keep Numa at arm's length from the sub's disappearance, then?
For now, Admiral.
I can assure you that Numa will not search for the NR-1. However, please let me know if and when we can be of help.
Of course we will, Admiral.
The president thanked everyone for coming and rose from his chair. Sandecker wished him good fishing and left the room, allowing the others to hash over the meeting, as he knew they would. The aide was waiting to escort him to a side door. As he drove through the gate a few moments later, the guard grinned.
Hot enough for you today, sir.
It must be my imagination, Norman, Sandecker said with a grin. The temperature always seems to be a few degrees warmer in this part of Washington. He gave a jaunty wave and drove out into the traffic. On the way back to Numa headquarters, Sandecker punched out a number on his cell phone. Rudy, please meet me in my office in 10 minutes. Sandecker drove into the garage under the 30-story tubular building that served as the nerve center for Numa's worldwide operations and took the elevator to his top-floor office. He was behind the immense desk made from the hatch cover of a Confederate blockade runner when Rudy Gunn arrived carrying a briefcase. Sandecker waved his second-in-command to a chair. Gunn, a short, thin man with narrow shoulders, thinning hair, and thick, horn-rimmed glasses, listened intently while Sandecker described his White House meeting.
Then we're pulling out of the search, Gunn said.
Sandecker's eyes blazed.
Hell no! The fact that they put a shot across my bow doesn't mean I'm going to heave to and run up the white flag. What have you learned?
I went right to work on the premise we had discussed, that the only thing with the ability to hijack the NR-1 from under the nose of its support ship would be a bigger sub. Any number of countries have submarines large enough to carry off the NR-1, Gunn said. I asked Yeager to run some profiles. Hiram Yeager was Numa's computer whiz and head of its vast data network. We concentrated on the USSR because of their preference for building monster boats. My first thought was something like the Typhoon. Sandecker sat back in his chair and cradled his chin in one hand.
The length of more than 500 feet, a Typhoon could easily piggyback our missing mini-sub.
I agree. They were designed to fire missiles from the Arctic Circle. The flat missile deck could have been converted for carrying cargo. But there was a problem when I checked further. All 6 Typhoons were accounted for.
All right. But I've never known you to give up easily, Rudy. What else do you have?
Gunn reached into his briefcase and pulled out a folder. He handed a picture from the folder to Sandecker.
This shows a Soviet India-class sub photographed on its way to the Pacific from the Northern Fleet. He passed over several sheets of paper. These are schematic diagrams. She's a diesel electric, nearly 350 feet long, and was designed supposedly for underwater rescue. That semi-recessed area abaft the sail was fitted out to carry a couple of deep-diving mini-subs. In wartime, they could be used for clandestine ops with Spetsnaz, Special Forces Brigades. Only two India-class subs were built. They were to have been broken up after the end of the Cold War. We've been able to verify that one was indeed scrapped. We don't know the fate of the other. I think it was used to hijack the NR-1.
You sound quite sure of this, Rudy. Remember, our premise is still only a theory.
Gunn smiled. May I borrow your VCR?
Be my guest.
Gunn dug into his case again and pulled out a video cassette, went over to the paneled wall, opened a door to a cabinet, and popped the cassette into the VCR. As you know, the NR-1 had the capability to broadcast the television picture from the ocean floor, Gunn said.
I approved the NUMA funds myself. Great educational program. The pictures bounce off a satellite and into classrooms around the world. Teaches youngsters that the ocean is a lot more interesting than MTV. I understand the program has worked out well.
Extremely well, in this case. This picture was sent from the NR-1 the day she disappeared. Gunn pressed the play button on the remote control. The screen went fuzzy, then turned seawater green. Bright floodlights illuminated a slender black hull. There was no sound. The time and date showed in the corner. Sandecker was sitting on the edge of his desk, arms folded.
Looks like the bow view from the sail cam, he said.
That's right. Keep on watching.
Right about now.
A shark-like shadow loomed below the hull. Something much bigger than the NR-1 had come up from below. After a few minutes, the sub began to move forward at great speed until it was obscured by bubbles. The screen went fuzzy again. This picture was sent from the sub via satellite at exactly the time of her disappearance. It only ran a short while, as you can see, before it was shut down.
Fascinating, Sandecker said. Run it again, please.
Gunn replayed the tape.
Does the White House have a copy of this video? Sandecker said.
The transmission came directly to NUMA. My guess is they haven't seen it.
Good work, Rudy, the Admiral said. There's an important piece of the puzzle missing, however.
He reached into the desk humidor and pulled out two cigars. He had them personally selected and rolled for him by the owner of a Dominican Republic plantation and held one cigar above the other.
Assume the bottom stogie is much larger than the one on top. It comes up under the smaller boat.
Then what? He moved the top cigar away.
You see what I'm getting at. There might be a problem getting the smaller sub to play piggyback.
Wouldn't be easy unless
the NR-1 were cooperating.
Which Captain Logan wouldn't do unless he were forced to.
Exactly my thoughts.
Sandecker tossed Gunn a cigar and clamped the other in his teeth. They lit up and sat in the cloud of fragrant smoke.
I understand there was a guest scientist aboard the NR-1, Sandecker said after a moment's thought.
That's right, I have the whole roster.
Go over their backgrounds with a fine-tooth comb, especially the scientists. In the meantime, let's try to find the India-class submarine. The Navy keeps track of all operational Russian submarines, but I don't want to alert anyone to the fact that NUMA is still in this.
I'll see if Jaeger can tap into the Navy computer system.
Why, Rudy, Sandecker said, studying the glowing ash on his cigar. What a surprising thing to hear from a Navy man. First in his class at the Academy, too.
Gunn tried without success to look angelic.
Desperate times call for desperate measures.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Austin called me from Istanbul.
He's assembling the special assignments team to take another look at that abandoned submarine base.
Does he think it has a connection with the NR-1?
He didn't know about the missing sub until I told him. No, apparently he's been in contact with someone, an old Russian friend, who indicated that the base may have something to do with a supposed threat against the U.S.
Terrorist activity?
I asked Kurt the same question. He only knows what the Russian told him, that the U.S. is in danger. A mining magnate named Ratsov seems to be involved, and the old base may hold the key to what is going on. Kurt's instincts are usually sound. This threat of his is all the more reason for Numa to get involved.
We can take a look at the area by satellite.
We still need eyes on the ground.
What about your promise to the president?
I only promised not to look for the NR-1. I never said anything about a Soviet sub-base.
Besides, Sandecker said with a twinkle in his eye, Austin is probably out of reach by now.
I've heard that sunspot activity has been interrupting communications.
We'll keep trying to establish contact, of course.
The president is going fly fishing in Montana, but I expect he'll return in a hurry if the Russian government falls.
Gunn looked worried. If there really is a threat, don't you think we should tell the president?
Sandecker walked over to the window and looked out over the Potomac. After a moment, he turned and said, Do you know how Sid Sparkman made his fortune?
Sure, he made millions in mining.
Correct. As did Ratsov.
Coincidence?
Maybe. Maybe not. There's often a worldwide good old boy network in certain areas of industry. It's not out of the question that they know each other. Unless we learn that the threat is imminent, I suggest we keep this conversation to ourselves for now.
Are you suggesting that there's a connection?
I'm not prepared to go that far.
Yet.
Gunn pursed his lips, a grave look in his eyes. I hope Kurt and his team aren't getting in over their heads. Sandecker smiled grimly, his eyes as hard as topaz. It wouldn't be the first time.
Chapter 11. The Black Sea. Austin strolled along the Bosporus past the ferry terminal and sleek tour vessels until the smell of decaying fish told his nostrils he was near the working waterfront. Raucous squadrons of gulls grew more numerous as he approached the ragtag fleet of fishing boats nuzzled up to the dock. With their paint-flaked woodwork and corroded metal, the sea-beaten rust bucket seemed to remain afloat by a miracle of levitation. Austin stopped at one exception, a solid-looking wooden boat that appeared to have undergone heroic maintenance. The black hull and white wheelhouse gleamed with many coats of paint, and the bright work was liberally soaked with oil. Reaching into his pocket, Austin pulled out a folded piece of notepaper and matched the scrawled word Turgut with the name painted in white on the stern. He smiled approvingly. He liked Captain Kemal without having met him. Turgut was a renowned 16th-century admiral in the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent. Anyone who would name an ancient fishing vessel after such a towering naval figure displayed a sense of history and humor. The deck was deserted except for a man in a double-breasted black suit. He sat on a coil of thick rope, mending a net spread across his knees. Austin called out a greeting in Turkish.
Merhaba. May I come aboard?
The man looked up.
Merhaba, he said, and beckoned Austin aboard.
Austin climbed a short gangway and stepped onto the deck. The boat was about 50 feet long, with a wide beam to provide stability as a fishing platform. His eyes swept the Turgut, taking in the extraordinary efforts that had been made to maintain a vessel that looked as if it went back to the Ottoman Empire itself. He went over to the seated man and said, I'm looking for Captain Kemal.
I'm Kemal, the man said.
His fingers flew over the mesh without missing a loop.
The captain was a slightly built man in his 50s. His face was narrow, his olive skin burnished to a reddish glow by sun and wind. He wore a woven skull cap over dark brown hair going to gray, and he was clean-shaven except for a toothbrush mustache that seemed to be held in place by the curve of his prominent nose. The soft wail of Turkish music came from a portable radio at his feet. "My name is Kurt Austin. I'm with the National Underwater and Marine Agency. I was on the Numa ship Argo when we found your cousin Mehmet's body." Kemal nodded solemnly and put the net aside. "Mehmet's funeral was this morning," he said, in well-spoken English. He plucked at his sleeve to show that he was wearing his best and only suit. "They told me on the Argo. I hope I'm not intruding by coming by so soon." The captain shook his head and indicated a nearby, waist-high stack of netting. "Sit, please, Mr. Austin. You speak English very well." "Thank you. When I was younger, I worked as a cook for the American airbase near Ankara." He smiled, displaying a brilliant gold tooth. "The pay was good. I worked very hard and saved the money to buy this boat." "I noticed you named it after a great admiral." Kemal raised a bushy eyebrow, impressed. "Turgut was a big hero to my people." "I know. I read a biography about him." The captain studied Kurt with deep-set liquid brown eyes. "Thank your Numa people for me. It would be very hard for Mehmet's family if they did not have his body to bury. I'll be sure to tell Captain Atwood and the Argo's crew of your appreciation. Miss Dorn mentioned your name." The captain smiled. "The beautiful television woman came by last night. She said Mehmet's widow will be well provided for. It will not bring Mehmet back, but it is more than he could have earned in his whole life." He shook his head in wonder. "God is great." "I called the hotel earlier, and they told me Miss Dorn had checked out." "She has gone to Paris. She wants to hire my boat again, but must get permission from her bosses." Austin received the news of Kayla's departure with mixed feelings. He regretted not having had the chance to get to know Kayla better, but the lovely TV reporter would have been a distraction. "What else did Miss Dorn say?"
"She told me what happened to Mehmet. She said men on horses shot at the TV people and killed my cousin." He frowned. "They are very bad men. Mehmet never hurt anyone."
"Yes, they are. Very bad men."
"She told me how you shot at them with your little plane. How many did you kill?"
"I'm not sure. There was one body."
"Good. Do you know who these people are who killed him?"
"No, but I intend to find out."
Kemal raised his eyebrows.
"You are going back to that place?"
"If I can find a boat to take me there."
"But you have the big Numa ship."
"It wouldn't be a good idea to use a government vessel." Austin glanced around at the Turgut. "I need something that won't attract attention."
The light of understanding dawned in the dark eyes.
"Something like a fishing boat, maybe."
Austin smiled.
"Yes,
something very much like a fishing boat."
The captain studied Austin's face, then got up and went into the wheelhouse. He reappeared with a large bottle and two chipped coffee mugs. He uncorked the bottle, poured liberal quantities into the mugs, and handed one to Austin.
"To Mehmet," he said,
raising his drink high in toast. They clinked the mugs, and Kemal took a generous swallow, gulping the strong drink down as if it were water. Austin knew from the licorice smell that the mug held the potent Turkish firewater known as Rocky. Although he did not ordinarily drink alcohol before the sun appeared over the yardarm, he didn't want to be impolite. He took a tentative sip and let the fiery liquor trickle down his throat, thinking that this is what it must be like to swallow broken glass. Kemal took another healthy swig and, to Austin's relief, set his mug aside. He affixed Austin with a leveled gaze.
Why would you want to go back there? You could be shot, too.
That's a possibility, but it wouldn't have to happen. Last time we had no warning or weapons. This time we will. Kemal pondered the answer. Austin was glad to see that the captain was not someone who made rash decisions. His coolness could come in handy. The Turk stared into his cup.
I feel responsible for Mehmet. I let him go with the TV people so he could make some extra money. No one could have predicted he would be shot.
Of course, you are right. I fished there many times with no trouble.
Would you ever go back?
Not for pay, no. Austin was disappointed, but not surprised.
I understand, Captain. It could be very dangerous, no matter how well prepared we are.
Fah! Kemal spat off to his side. I am not afraid. I said I would not go there for pay.
I owe you a favor for killing that pig.
He dismissed Austin's protest with a wave of his hand.
The Turgut is at your disposal, he said, as grandly as if he were turning over the wheel of the QE2.
You're not obligated to me in any way. The captain thrust his chin forward. Speaking in measured tones to make sure there was no mistaking his intentions, he said,
The men who killed my cousin are the ones who must be made to pay. I am not a stranger to these affairs. As a young man, I was a smuggler. I was never caught.
He thumped the deck with his heel and flashed his 14-carat grin.
Twin diesels, he said proudly. 30 knots, cruising speed.
When do you wish to go?
I'm expecting 3 other people from the United States today. I have to round up some equipment as well. How about tomorrow morning?
The boat will be fueled up and ready at dawn.
What about crew? Austin said. I don't want to place anyone in danger after what happened to Mehmet.
Thank you. I will keep 2 crewmen, my most trusted. I will warn them about the danger so they can make a choice.
I know what they will say.
They are cousins to Mehmet, too.
They shook hands on the deal. Austin said he would be there with the sun.
He left before Kemal wanted to seal the agreement with another cup of Rocky. His head was spinning on the walk back to the Argo, though by the time he returned to the Numa ship, the fresh air off the Bosporus had cleared away most of the alcoholic vapors. He went up to the bridge to see Captain Atwood, who was poring over some charts.
"How's the television star?" he asked.
"You've obviously heard about what a natural I am before the cameras," Atwood replied.
"Okay.
I admit it," he said with a sheepish grin. "I had a good time filming with those crazy characters. My guess is that they'll edit out my pretty mug in favor of the lovely Miss Dorn."
"Would you blame them?"
"Hell no, not in 100 years.
I'm surprised you didn't make a move on the lady. Losing your touch?"
"My heart belongs only to Numa," Austin said, placing his hand on his chest. "Which brings up why I'm here. I'm going to need some help. No questions asked."
The captain cocked his head. He had known Austin a long time and never knew the man to leave business of any sort unfinished.
"We'll do what we can, as long as it doesn't involve putting the Argo or its crew in jeopardy."
"It won't. All I need is the loan of some gear."
Austin summarized his wish list and asked that the equipment be delivered to the Turgut.
None of it would be a problem, the captain said. While Atwood ordered up the requested gear, Austin went to his cabin and plugged in his laptop computer. He called up a commercial satellite imaging company off the internet and requested photos of a location on the Russian coast of the Black Sea. He examined the photos closely, but wasn't surprised when nothing unusual popped out at him. The Soviets would not be advertising their secret base. He punched out a number on his Global Star phone. It was still early back in the States, but he knew from his days of working with the CIA that Sam Leahy would be in his office. "How's the weather at Langley?" Austin said when Leahy's brass-lunged voice came on the phone. There was a pause. "You got the wrong number, pal. If you're looking for a goddamn weather report, call the National Underwater and Marine Agency. Hell, I hear the smart Alex and Newman know everything there is to know." "Almost everything, Sam. That's why I'm calling for your help." "I knew you'd come crawling back to the company. Great hearing from you. How have you been, you old sea dog?" "I'm fine. They still have you tied to a desk?" "Not for long. Retirement is in 6 months. Then it's running fishing charters in the Chesapeake. I could use a first mate if you ever get tired of the Washington rat race." "Sounds tempting. Put me down for a charter at the very least. Right now, I could use some information. What do you know about Soviet sub-bases?" "Broad subject. Anything in particular you'd like to know?"
"Yes. How were they physically constructed?"
"To begin with, they were big. They had to be large enough to accommodate the babies like the Typhoon, with a length of 557 feet. The beam alone was 75 feet. Those monsters were armed with 20 nukes apiece. The Soviets wanted them protected from a nuclear attack, so they built the pens deep. They learned from the German U-boat pen construction that held up pretty well under Allied bombing. Basically, they'd blast a tunnel out of a hillside and line it with several yards of reinforced granite."
"Do you have any data on the where and how of these bases?"
"I can get it." Austin heard an unspoken conditional in the answer.
"It would really be a help if you could dig out what you can."
"No problem. Lots of that stuff has been declassified anyhow. But I'll hold you to that promise to do a charter." Austin was relieved. He'd expected Leahy to say he would have to run the request through his higher-ups. "You provide the bait, and I'll bring the beer." Austin gave Leahy his email address, thanked him again, and hung up. He worked out some logistical problems on his computer, then he went out to check on the preparations for his trip with Captain Kamal. The equipment he'd asked for was stacked in boxes on the deck and ready to go. A truck was on its way to run the equipment to the Turgut. Austin had done all he could until he heard from the special assignments team. He didn't have to wait long. As he was taking an equipment inventory, his phone buzzed. It was Joe Zavala calling.
"We're at the airport," Zavala said.
"What took you so long?" Zavala sighed loudly.
"That's gratitude for you. You yanked me out of the arms of the most beautiful woman on the planet."
"Every woman you've ever been involved with was the most beautiful woman on the planet."
"What can I say? I am a fortunate man.
One day you'll thank me for rescuing you from the bonds of matrimony."
"Matrimony? A sobering thought. Don't even joke about it."
"We can talk about your love life later. How soon will you be at the Argo?"
"Gamay is nailing down a cab, and Paul is humping the luggage out to the curb. We'll be there sooner than you can spell Constantinople."
Within the hour, Zavala and the Trouts arrived at the hotel. After a brief reunion, Zavala said,
"Not that it matters, but we were wondering if you could give us a hint why we raced halfway across the world at warp speed."
"I missed your smiling faces?"
"Right," Zavala said. "That's why you asked me to bring along your shooting iron and my own metal delivery system."
"I'll admit I had an ulterior motive, but I'm not lying when I say it's good to see you."
Austin glanced around at the other members of the Special Assignments team and grinned with pleasure at their eager expressions. Then he began to outline his plan. Chapter 12. Rocky Point, Maine. The image on the oversized computer monitor looked like the profile of a very tall tortoise. Leroy Jenkins clicked the computer mouse until the shell flattened as if it had been run over by an 18-wheeler. Jenkins made some computations from the numbers on the screen, then exploded with the blue lightning curses he usually reserved for a tangled lobster pot line. He turned away from the computer and swiveled his chair so he was facing out a big picture window. From its position high on the hill, the tall, white, clapboard house offered an unequaled view of the harbor and the sea beyond. The harbor swarmed with activity. Front-end loaders scooped scattered debris into a waiting line of dump trucks. Forklifts, normally used to hoist boats onto multi-story racks for winter storage, were plucking battered wrecks from the parking lot and lining them up where their owners could claim them. Cranes had been brought in to pick remnants of the motel off the breakwaters. Jenkins' boat was tied up at the town pier, with the others lucky enough to have been out of the way when the big wave struck. Jenkins rubbed his eyes and turned back to the computer to enter some new numbers. After a few minutes, he shook his head in frustration. He had gone through the modeling process dozens of times, feeding in different combinations of data, and his findings still didn't make sense. Jenkins was grateful when the doorbell rang. He went out into the hallway and yelled down the stairs, "Come in!" The door opened and Charlie Howe stepped inside. "Not bothering you, am I?" the police chief said. "Hell no, Charlie, come on up. I was just fiddling around on the computer." The chief climbed to the second floor office. "You've done a nice job with the house," he said, glancing around at the well-ordered space with its neatly arranged filing cabinets and bookcases. "Thanks, Charlie. Wish I could claim credit." He picked up a framed photograph of a handsome, middle-aged woman who was smiling directly at the camera from a sailboat cockpit. "Mary knew that I'd need more than lobstering to keep my brain from fossilizing. Setting up my office in the attic space was her idea. You know how she was. She can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. She didn't do a bad job of filing down some of your rough edges." Jenkins laughed. "I consider that a miracle, given the material she had to work with." He glanced out the window again. "Looks like they're making progress down there. Getting the harbor cleared out real fast. There was some worry about oil spills from the fuel tanks, but the environmental people from the state got it under control. I needed a break from the press people. Started getting in the way anyhow, with all the insurance guys showing up." He jerked his head toward the computer. "See, you've been working. Got things figured out yet?" "Been trying." "Pull up a seat and take a look. I could use your detective's intuition." Despite the chief's folksy language and country ways, he was no bumpkin. Howes had a master's degree in criminal science from the state university. He replied with a skeptical snort, dragged a stool next to Jenkins's chair, and squinted into the computer monitor. "What's that thing that looks like a pregnant snake?" Jenkins raised an eyebrow. "Rorschach would have a field day with you. What do you know about tsunamis?" "I know I never want to see one again." "Well, that's a good start. Let me don my professor's hat and I'll give you a crash course." He wrote out the word "su" and "nami" on a pad of paper. These words represent the Japanese characters for harbor and wave. An international conference adopted the term in 1963 to avoid confusion. I always heard them called tidal waves. That was the popular term, but it isn't accurate. Tides come from gravitational forces such as the moon, sun, and planets. Even we scientists were wrong. We called them seismic sea waves, which implies that earthquakes generate all tsunamis. A quake is only one cause. You think a quake caused that mess out there?
Yes. No. Maybe. He grinned at the chief's befuddled reaction and ripped a sheet of paper off the pad. Here's the real culprit. He held the paper horizontally. Make believe this is the ocean bottom. He pushed the ends in so that the middle of the paper humped up. A quake occurs when tectonic plates bump together and deform the seafloor. This hump pushes up the column of water all the way to the surface. The water tries to regain its equilibrium. You're losing me, Jenkins thought for a moment. It's like Joe Johnson, the town drunk, staggering home after a night on the town. Reason he zigzags is because the booze has affected his equilibrium. He has to keep catching himself from going off in the wrong direction. Sometimes he can't stop and slams into a wall and knocks himself out. He frowned. Okay, it's a rough analogy. I get the picture. Think of Joe as that column of water and the wall as the main coast. Only difference is the wall gets the worst of it, not Joe. How come every wave isn't a potential tidal wave? Tsunami. I knew your policeman's logic would come into play. Two reasons. Time and distance. The time between waves hitting the beach is 5 to 20 seconds. With a tsunami, that time can be 10 minutes to 2 hours. The distance between the waves is called the wavelength. Beach waves can be 300 to 600 feet apart. With a tsunami, you're talking 300 miles plus. I've seen some pretty destructive beach waves. So have I, but even an ordinary wave crashing on the beach only has a short life and a speed of 10 to 20 miles per hour. Your tsunami has had hundreds of miles and hours to build up its energy. The deeper the water, the faster the wave. That's why a tsunami can hit 600 miles per hour as it crosses the ocean, even though ships don't feel it and you can't see it from the air. Let me give you an example. In 1960, an offshore quake near Chile sent a wave across the Pacific. The wave was no more than 3 feet high. 22 hours later, when the wave hit the coast of Japan, it was 20 feet high and killed 200 people. The wave bounced around the Pacific for days, causing damage wherever it touched. If it's only a ripple in the ocean, how do you figure this was going to be a big one? I was lobstering out on the ledge, where it's comparatively shallow. The wave slowed down when it hit the shallows and started to peak. It was moving slower, but all the energy it built up was still there. That energy has to go somewhere. When the wave approaches shore, the mousy little sea grows up into a monster. Sometimes it builds up into a great, towering wave. It might be a bunch of series of breaking waves or a bore, like a bunch of steps with a steep breaking front. It might suck out the water and spit it back out. That's what happened with us. Like someone pulled the plug out of the harbor. Jenkins nodded. Tsunamis are fascinating.